Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an independent asset management firm offering comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for clients nationwide. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Well, it's the end of May, but you wouldn't know it from the weather we're having here, at least in southern Wisconsin. Seems like a cold spring, at least it does to me, but is that the case? We always enjoy our monthly visit from our weather guys from UW-Madison. They explain what we've seen and tell us what to watch out for and generally just make science and meteorology a whole lot of fun. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, back once again, also a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve, great to have you back.
Great to be back in this wonderful weather. April weather.
April weather. And John Martin, also professor, chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Good to see you, John.
Yeah, good to see you, Larry.
Yeah, so, and you've got sons who play ball.
Yeah, my son is on the varsity team at Edgewood High School. They're supposed to play tonight in their regional semifinal for the state tournament, but I don't know what they're going to say over the powers that be at 1 o'clock getting ready for the Mallards Wednesday through Saturday. May not like high school is trampling on a wet field. So we were talking about it on the way over. We need to get some wind and we need to get a little bit of sun. I think we won't get either.
Right.
So now, then we need a little bit of luck.
Well, is it really cooler at this time of the year than normal? I mean, it seems like it to me.
It seems that way, but it's about normal. Mm. It's just a little bit cooler, maybe a degree cooler than normal throughout most of the state. So, yeah, I don't know why it just seems so cold.
Well, I think it's because of last year. A year ago today was 94,
that's true.
Which is an all-time high for the day.
94?
So, yeah, so we started off in the 90s in late April last year. And so, you know, people said the summer began right after tax day last year. And that's fairly accurate.
Right, yeah.
Not this year. So it might just be that residual memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be the wind. I mean, is it windier?
It's been cloudy. It's probably been more cloudy than normal.
That's the thing that's got me is it's just been persistently cloudy.
Drizzling.
Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, John Martin with us today. You can join in with your own question, be it weather or climate. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment there. And we always love to see your photos, your weather photos. We've seen some pretty interesting ones pretty much every month. So post those on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And if you've witnessed an interesting weather phenomenon lately, of course, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. So precipitation, are we about average for that then, too?
We're pretty close to average, too, for the month. I don't know about for the season.
Actually, about an inch above for the month.
About a month?
We're at the end of May. But
okay.
For the season, we're way ahead. And for the year, we're way ahead. I think it's 3 or 4 inches above normal. So it's really way ahead.
And that's right. And the drought that we've been having is pretty much cleared.
It's over.
It's over for
the southern part of the state, anyway. Yeah.
Northern, though? Is it still?
The very far northern end up by Minnesota is still a little bit, but not as bad as it has been for the past year or so.
Yeah, and they had 2 or 3 summers prior to the last one that were pretty dry.
Desperately dry,
but so they've had a really integrated dry period.
Yeah, yeah.
Just last week, oh my goodness, Oklahoma, one of those destructive, terrible tornadoes. What conditions were in play there? Have you looked that over?
Yeah, sort of the classic conditions where you have a lower level. Part of the atmosphere, lowest kilometer, let's say, lowest mile, warm and moist. Above that, by virtue of the fact that air gets kind of sent out off the Mexican Plateau into the Central Plains, the air is warm and bone dry. And you put those two kinds of air masses on top of each other, you can really have some explosive instability that'll develop. And then in addition, routinely there's some kind of jet stream structure at that time of year, early May, mid-May, in that location that provides wind direction, speed, and speed changes with height, and that's the third ingredient you need. So we end up with some really severe thunderstorms, some of which spawned this monster tornado in Moore, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And pretty amazing. I mean, it was a what, it went from like May 18th to the 21st or so in terms of the number of storms that were kicking off tornadoes. And,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and the National Weather Service, like on 5 days before that, on the 13th, gave a heads up that
sure
this
did.
Is region very susceptible to very severe weather.
Oh, they did.
They did. So there were that's right. People were saying 5, sometimes 7 days in advance they were had been put on alert that next week, next Monday, next Tuesday is going to be a really scary time. So I suspect that had something to do with a fairly minimal loss of life given the size and intensity of that storm.
Yeah. So the warning system worked pretty well.
Well, that's always a question. There's two different things there. The forecast just keeps getting better. We keep alerting ourselves to these things several days in advance. That's one component of the alert system. The second is how do people respond when they get that alert? And that's a subject that's still being, you know, investigated. And I think that's probably the weak link, even today.
Yeah. Well, Phil in Woodstock, Illinois, has something on that. Phil, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, you guys. I was on the internet as that storm was going into Moore and watching the National Weather Service's warnings and severe warnings. And I saw something I never saw before. The Weather Service put on their warning, to survive this storm, you will need to be below ground. Mm. I've never seen that before. Have those guys ever seen that on a big storm?
Wow.
Wow. No, I have not heard that either.
Yeah. I have not either. That's really interesting. Now, one of the things that's changed in the last 20 or 30 years is the amount of lead time because of remote observations of these things. You can see these tornadoes before somebody on the ground can report that they see it themselves. You see it with the Doppler radar. That warning time's gone to 15 minutes. So maybe they've said, let's do something extra with those extra 10 minutes that we've gained over, you know, since the mid-1980s and say things like that. I've just never noticed that before, but that's remarkable and positive.
Yeah, that is good. I mean, I was out of town, but then on a listserv, and it was amazing to watch the emails that were coming across saying, oh, my goodness, oh, my goodness. It's pretty.
So I wonder what they meant by be underground. Would that be in your basement?
Yes, get to a safe. But that, they were probably saying total destruction and knowing that you needed to get below ground because houses were getting destroyed, I guess.
Right.
They would. Again, you can't forecast how strong the tornado is until after it does its damage.
Yeah.
So there must have been somebody out there spotting it and seeing the damage and reporting it back to know what was happening.
Right.
Because you can have very large tornadoes and they're not that strong in terms of their wind speed and destructive power.
Yeah.
Well, this one was...
this was big and strong.
Yeah.
It was an EF5, so it was the strongest category tornado that we categorize.
Carl in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, hello. I've been active with different climate change organizations, and I've been paying attention to the difference between last year and this year in terms of, you know, the record heat, and then we don't have it so much this year. And I was listening to a researcher, I believe out of Rutgers, and I don't have her name, but talking about the jet stream up in the Arctic, that when the Arctic is warm so much faster than the rest of the planet, it has had the effect of making the jet stream sort of stall and meander so that you get stuck with a particular kind of weather for quite a period of time, maybe drought for quite a period of time or excessive heat or a lot of moisture. And so this kind of crazy one season to the next or one year to the next, even though it's not consistently hot or consistently drought, that there tends to be these wild swings that then sustain themselves for a period of time in a given area. And I was just curious the guest's thoughts on that research or that idea.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've heard of the same idea, and I don't agree with it. I think that there's some things there that still need to be investigated. Number one, that research does not come along with statements or analyses of whether or not there have been longer periods of blocking or longer periods of cold air outbreaks in the wintertime or anything like that. So there's really nothing except a theoretical idea suggesting that we're going to have more prolonged types of strange weather events. That's a supposition. And also, I think that when one focuses on the polar latitudes as driving the jet stream structures, I think this is a potential mistake. I'm not sure about this as much as I am on the first one. We're currently in my group researching both the subtropical and the polar jet streams, and it seems to me that a large part of the jet stream energy around the globe, around the hemisphere, is driven by the subtropical jet, not so much by the polar jet. If the polar jet does disappear as the high latitudes warm, we will have ramifications for that. I don't know what they'll be, but I don't think it'll manifest itself in terms of prolonged periods of drought, prolonged periods of cold air, and so on. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Interesting.
So you were doing research, too, on the cold cap and how that's been changing in polar regions.
That's right.
Is that associated with the jet stream stuff that you're doing?
I think that it is, but I haven't made that connection yet. Yeah, I think the stronger the jet at high latitudes, the more able it is to contain cold air at high latitudes, which would make the area of the cold air coverage smaller.
Right.
But I don't think that, so that'll be the next step, is this decrease in the area of cold air over the season associated with a stronger jet. And this is in direct contradiction to what they're saying at Rutgers.
Right.
So. Yeah. Either way, either that has got some things to be fixed or we've got some things to be fixed. But that's the nature of science.
Right. Yeah. This is why we do science. It's fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
Carl, thank you. Appreciate the call. John in Chippewa Falls, hello.
Hi. I just got a comment, follow-up comment on a previous caller.
Yeah.
I heard this spring that the National Weather Service had upgraded their warnings. And one of the statements that they were going to include was a new one called, where it would say, you could be killed.
Mm. So potentially fatal storm.
Do you remember what it is? I just read this. We're redoing a fourth edition of our introductory textbook. And in reviewing the galleys, I remember to add a little paragraph on that. And I can't remember what the phrase is. But it's something like extreme tornado or...
No, the phrase I heard was, you could be killed.
You could be killed. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that would go with, get below ground.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I had. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. No, that's good. Yeah, there's a phrase that they're now coming out with tornadoes, too, that tell you that these are really dangerous and you should do something or you're in real bad trouble.
Somebody will look those up for us. Yeah. Judith May, she's probably going to have it before too long. In the next minute or so, let's talk about hurricanes. We hit tornadoes. What about hurricanes? How's the hurricane season looking?
Well, NOAA came out with its forecast for an above-average hurricane season. Yeah. I think they're going with three to six major hurricanes is what they're forecasting.
20 of them will earn names, I think.
Right. So, and normally there is, 12 total named storms or something?
Yeah,
so
12
it's pretty
to 14,
active.
Something in there, yeah. That's higher than average.
And that starts June 1 and runs for 6 months.
Yeah.
And how do they deserve a name?
If they reach speeds of 35 miles per hour?
I think it's 39. Tropical
39?
Storm is 39.
Tropical storm, yeah. Then
Once
they get a name.
A tropical storm, they get a name.
Yeah. And they pick names out, five years in advance. Yeah. And unless one of them gets really bad, like Katrina, then they retire the name.
Right.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
they'll reuse it.
Well, we got a whole tropical storm of information they have to cover here as we visit with our two,
nice segue.
Our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin, Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30, so you stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is always fascinating, isn't it? Might be a double rainbow after a storm or the storm itself. Always something to learn and appreciate about the weather. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today. We have something else to appreciate, and that's our monthly visit with the UW weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Great to have both of them with us today to answer your questions about weather and climate. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. John's professor and chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and is also a professor in John's department. And great to have you back, by the way, guys. Thanks.
Yeah, good to be here.
Great to be here.
Joe in Parade of Sheen has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Say, the jet streams. Could you explain how they're formed and their implications and so on? I didn't realize there was a subtropical one, so I'm assuming there are actually four around the planet. And also, as an aside, is Eurasia experiencing the same type of conditions that we are here in North America?
What kind of conditions do you mean?
Well, drought, the cyclical stuff that seems to be coming along, and the big dip we have this season in the jet stream. Is there one in Eurasia, or are they balanced? Are they off balance?
Oh, I see.
Or just random?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Okay.
And does this same thing occur, say, across Australia and South America?
Yeah. Good question. So the first part about the jet streams, I think you're right that there really probably would be considered four different jet stream structures across the globe, both hemispheres. There's two in each hemisphere, broadly speaking. And these are ribbons of high-speed winds that occur near the tropopause. And the tropopause is the boundary between the troposphere and the stratosphere, and its height is going to vary across the across either hemisphere. At high latitudes near the poles, the height of the tropopause is fairly low, so the jet stream's low. And in, near the equator, the tropopause is fairly high, so the so-called subtropical jet stream is much higher elevation than the polar jet stream. And these two features are usually separated by a fairly good amount of distance in the north-south direction, but occasionally they are right on top of each other in the vertical, and they and when that happens, you can get really intense weather at the surface, because one of the characteristics of the jet stream is that it's characterized by really strong horizontal shear. The wind speeds are different across the jet, and they tend to be curved features as well. And so they are really strong foci for the development of weather systems in the middle latitudes and also some convective features in the tropical latitudes. So they're a really important driver of the day-to-day weather in both hemispheres.
Very interesting. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Jen in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
You know, it seems to me that over the last 10, 15 years, the accuracy of the local weather forecasters has really improved. I mean, really improved.
Seems like it anyway. Yeah. Jen, because you're breaking up, we're going to cut you off right there, but how it really has been a significant improvement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really has. I'm trying to think now that the 5-day forecast is equivalent to what the 3-day forecast was just half a dozen years ago or so.
Yeah, oh, in terms
Remember?
Of accuracy?
Yeah, in terms
yeah,
of
that's
accuracy.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, so we keep extending the accuracy out, too. So not only is it good in terms of, you know, getting the right temperature close to the precipitation,
yeah.
But actually, yeah, what used to be good for 3 days is now good out to 5 days.
Yeah.
And even better, I mean, I think 10 years ago, we never would have believed a forecast that said, look out for severe weather in Oklahoma 5 days from now.
That's right. That's right. Those kind of things didn't even exist.
Yeah.
It's
in fact, there was a
revolution.
I was telling a friend that you should never believe, this was like 10 years ago, I said, you never believe these 3-4-day forecasts. I mean, they're just garbage. And he called me on that the other day
yeah.
when I was, you know, talking about down the road a week from now it's going to be nice. He
yeah.
was like, I thought you said we shouldn't believe these things.
Yeah,
well,
that's
like, changed. Well, we've gotten better.
Yeah, that has changed. It's amazing.
Very cool. Peter in Stoughton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. My thoughts are, well, we'll put it this way. You were speaking earlier about things that are added on to weather warnings, which I believe can be quite useful. But I'm wondering why the folks in Sullivan seem to think that I would be concerned about a thunderstorm that's 100 miles away and then go on to inform me that, you know, I should stay out of the rain, I should go indoors and this and that. Thunderstorms like this have been happening for centuries, and I believe it's reached a situation of where they're crying wolf. We listeners who are getting these warnings don't know if this is something we should be concerned about or if this is just another thunderstorm, as I said, miles and miles away from where I live.
Yeah. Well, they have a responsibility for a large forecast area. That's one thing.
Yeah.
So, and it's easily dozens or tens of miles from one end of that forecast area to another, sometimes hundreds of miles in other parts of the country. So they're doing their best to give you an advance warning about what might occur in your vicinity in the next hour or two, usually when it comes to thunderstorm stuff, maybe even sometimes 12 hours out. And I think that they try to characterize the threat that the storm has in a variety of different degrees. Now, admittedly, I think that the wording has changed in some of those degrees, and the inclusion of many such degrees in the warning message has, you know, changed as well. I think these are all improvements, but they do take a while to get used to, especially some of the new words that we were talking about earlier. They do take a while to get used to. How do you gauge what they mean? But they're trying to be as accurate as the technology and the advances in forecasting allow. And those advances in both categories are substantial. So the degree to which we can say these things with more specificity is actually there, and we're trying to take advantage of that.
Yeah, you raise a good point, John, with regard to the areas. You know, they have to forecast for a big area, and that's where the warning goes out for. It's going to be interesting, I think, in the next 5 years or so, you know, with the mobile devices that people carry around, which have GPS on it and pinpoint you, if they won't be even zooming down to your pocket.
Yeah, right, right.
In a lot of time.
Possible.
So it's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens.
Yeah,
that's something I almost bet on that.
Yeah.
In 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, the caller,
maybe
has a,
sooner.
The caller has a really good point. This notion of crying wolf can be a perception, and I think it's somewhat misplaced in this case, but there certainly is a long history towards, you know, when forecasts weren't as accurate and the technology to detect these storms was nowhere near as plentiful and useful as it is now, that you might have to get people over-alerted to something. Now I think it's... one should take those alerts in the context of much better precise information and really kind of say, hey, this is probably more a serious threat than it is a crying wolf. Because I think you're right that there's a history there that you have to try to shed as much as you can and put your faith in the new technology and the new systems.
Thank you again for... Yeah, you know, when I'm thinking about this, I'm, you know, was coming over from my office to the studios here today, which is a good walk across campus. And it had been raining earlier, so I just sort of, I went online on my smartphone, looked up the weather, looked up a radar.
And tells you where you are. Right?
Yeah, right where I am. And what's
animated.
And what does the map look like? You know, what's coming? Oh, well, looks like I maybe could take along the umbrella, but probably not going to need it.
I tell you a short story?
Yeah.
My son graduated last Friday. We went out to dinner on Saturday, I think, for graduation for him. Maybe it was Friday afternoon. I forget. Anyway, we're at the Great Dane downtown. We're sitting outside in the grotto. Great place to sit.
Yeah.
The waitress tells us as we're finishing up dinner. My parents are here from Massachusetts. The waitress tells us as we're finishing up dinner, hey, I don't know how far away your car is, but we just looked at the radar, and it's going to really rain here intensely in the next 15 minutes, but it won't last that long. I didn't tell her what I do for a living, but I was sitting there, mouth agape. I'm getting a forecast, a nowcast, from a waitress at a restaurant because of the proliferation of this information. And you know, she was dead on. It rained like crazy for 15 minutes. We barely got to the car. By the time we got home, 25 or so minutes later, it was not raining anymore.
Yeah.
Absolutely the best forecast ever by a waitress.
Yeah.
And it was right on the money. And it's because of these advances in the proliferation of this information.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Pat in Mosinee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to have an explanation of something my daughter experienced a couple weeks ago, and it was a beautiful day. She went outside of her house to go down to a dock that they have along the river, and heard a lot of noises and thought the neighbors were doing some construction, but it was a very strange noise. And as she got down to the water, she saw winds that actually raised a funnel about 4 feet tall. It progressed then into some trees, actually bending them down. It all took about 10 minutes. And after that, it was totally calm and totally clear. When she got back to her house, she has some solar lanterns in the front of her house, and those were scattered. We used to call those kind of things whirlwinds, but that seemed pretty extensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a clear day, not a cloudy or anything?
Clear day.
Huh. Okay.
And this was in Mosinee? So it wasn't like in Arizona or something?
No, it was actually north of Stevens Point along the Wisconsin River.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Wow.
I wonder if this... Go ahead.
It got windy prior to or during the time she heard these noises, and I think the noises were actually going through a grove of pine trees. And after it got quiet, the only thing she heard was very upset geese. She thinks maybe their nests were even destroyed.
Wow.
In clear sky, no precipitation. I wonder if there was any precipitation, you know, 50, 25 miles away, anything like that. Because I'm just wondering if this wasn't some sort of a stray gust front sort of phenomenon, far away from clouds, that could have just come down the river valley and get channeled a little bit by the river valley and then turns into a really quite an impressive, advancing edge of high momentum air. So strong winds and all kinds of things going on, but fairly short-lived. But in the absence of that, boy, I don't know. That's a really great story. Yeah. You got some local gustiness that came out of somewhere.
So that's called a gustnado, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
You can take that gust front. You know, probably a lot of people have felt it, not that severe, where it's hot and muggy, and then all of a sudden you get hit by this blast of cool air, and then eventually a thunderstorm comes.
Right.
And sometimes that gets turned around and generates a whirlwind.
Exactly.
Called a gustnado, because it's not really
And you know, the
strong.
River connection makes me think that you might be able to transport this feature further
down
from the thunderstorm.
Yeah.
You know, it's
river
usually
valley.
Pretty close to the thunderstorm.
Yeah.
But if you're far enough away along a river valley, maybe you get it like that.
Yeah.
It would actually have come from the east and moved towards the river, approximately 8 acres or so.
Yeah, that's really
possible.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's
very
really
interesting. Thanks, Pat. Appreciate the call. That's very interesting.
Boy, yeah.
Yeah,
just when we think we know everything.
I've never had that thought once in my life.
Oh, you probably did when you were like 13.
Yeah, when I was 13, I did. Yeah,
13 through 19, probably.
Keith and Kiwani, hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm about 10 miles off Lake Michigan and lived here about 30 years, and it seemed like in the past our winds were predominantly westerly, northwesterly, southwesterly, whatever. But it seems like the last few years we get an awful lot of southerly and easterly winds, and it just seems like it's changed. Is that real or my imagination?
I would guess, I'm not going to say that it's imagined, but I don't know that it's real. I can't say that I know that. I think you probably tend to have more obvious weather phenomena coming with southerly and easterly winds. So if you're paying attention to what kind of weather phenomena you have, cloudy days, maybe rainy days, they're more likely to be associated with those southerlies and easterlies. So if you're paying attention and you say, I think we've had more cloudy or more rainy days, then it might lead you to say, I think we have more southerly and more easterly winds. But I don't know if it's actually true.
Yeah. This is a question for Ed Hopkins, the assistant state climatologist, because a lot of people have been saying this about winds, about either the wind speed picking up or the direction changing. And I remember asking Ed that once, and I think it was a problem. I think I asked him for Madison. I think there was an issue about changing the instrumentation, so it was kind of hard to tell what was going on. But
yeah,
I'll have to ask him again.
We've got flags that have flown out in front of our place for years. And it just seems like, they're pointing from the east an awful lot, and from the southeast.
Mm.
Huh. I mean, that would be the direction you would expect a lake breeze to come from.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if the land is getting warmer, maybe we're getting more lake breezes.
Could be.
You're not that far from Lake Michigan.
And the timing of them might be different, so that you happen to be watching it at times a day when it used to be offset a little bit. So that's a good point. That could be part of what's going on there.
There you go, Keith. Thank you.
Sounds like we know everything, doesn't it?
Appreciate that.
We can certainly come up with an answer.
Right.
Christopher in Janesville. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering about the Fujita scale for tornadoes. I was wondering if it had been revised recently or something, because the most recent really bad tornado in Oklahoma, I keep hearing, was classified as an EF5, and I was unaware of that classification.
Of the E.
Yeah, so the E means enhanced. And what happened is they did have to upgrade it because building codes got better. And so classifying a tornado is based on the damage it does. And so one of the categories is complete destruction of buildings. And so if you improve the building codes, then it gets harder to destroy the building. And so they had to redefine the Fujita scale by going to the enhanced Fujita scale.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see here. We got Bill in Fitchburg next. Hi, Bill.
Hey, guys. Hey, I love the show. Try to tune in as much as I can. Say, I saw a study. I can't quote it. It's been a while ago, but there's some speculation, I guess, that due to climate change, the jet stream is going to become more amplified. Probably just more energy, and I was wondering if you guys saw any evidence of that.
Yeah, we were just talking about that, as a matter of fact, earlier today. I think the same study underlies both of the comments. I think there's a lot to yet be examined along those lines. One of the things that people refer to as the jet stream is an average wind speed, you know, over a period of months, and that thing does not really take into account the fact that there's two very clear jet stream features in both hemispheres, northern and southern hemisphere, and they meander on their own. Sometimes they interact with each other. So I'm very hesitant to embrace statements such as the jet stream is becoming more energetic or more wavy. Not that they may not be true, but they just not haven't been proven yet. These are still ideas that are being hatched, and they need to be investigated. And some of that investigation is being done right here at Wisconsin in my research group. We're quite interested in understanding more about the behavior of the jet over the last 50 years. But in a sort of
tracked over time.
Yeah, we have information that goes back to 1948 that we can use with a fair degree of reliability to say something about what the jet stream looked like in terms of how it was distributed, wind speeds, maybe even integrated energy of it. And we can make statements about that as we do the analysis. We haven't finished all that analysis yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm, cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
So you mentioned earlier there's two fundamentally jet streams that we deal with our weather, right? There's the polar front jet, which is driven by temperature gradients.
That's right.
So if we see a warming, of the changing of that gradient, that might change that jet stream.
That's correct.
And then the subtropical jet, which is really driven by conservation of angular momentum.
Right, exhaust out the top of tropical thunderstorms in the so-called Hadley cell.
So if the only way you could really change that, the temperature gradient wouldn't change that unless you change the size of the so-called Hadley cell.
Yeah, and the intensity of the convection, that's correct.
And the intensity of the convection,
that's correct.
Right.
That's exactly right. And there is evidence that the Hadley cell is expanding poleward in both hemispheres, which means the subtropical jet's coming further towards the pole, and so it makes interaction with the polar jet more likely.
Mm-hmm. Would it make it stronger then, too?
Because I think any time they interact, you get a much stronger circulation, both the primary circulation of the wind speed itself of the jet and also the secondary circulations which drive the weather. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're investigating right now. Oh.
Yeah. Sorry, that was interesting.
No, that was. And
we chased all our callers away.
We had an email from Bliss who went, this sort of relates here. We've noticed that TV weather forecasts no longer include maps indicating the location of the jet stream. Hmm. Is this a direct cause of most weather patterns? It seems an important element of the forecast. Why has it fallen out of favor? I haven't really...
I'm trying to think of... I don't watch much television, if any, when I'm living in Madison. Mm-hmm. But when I travel, I do. And I'm kind of remembering that's right. Unless there's like a split flow, the local channel sends to show it, the city that I'm in.
Anyway. I think it's never really cracked the daily weather broadcast in any location I've ever lived. Mentioning the jet, it really would be a good idea, but there isn't a level of education involved in making people recognize it. Although they've passed the test with radar. Everybody knows what to interpret the radar. People would be able to do it. People are smart. The Tom Skilling on WGN always has the jet stream, and that has not receded in recent years. But he has a 5 or an 8 minute weather broadcast that he's earned over 30 years. I think part of it's commercial. They don't have enough time, and as a consequence, they have to decide what they're going to cut out. And the jet stream has a little bit of intellectual overhead. I think they decide to jettison that.
Yeah,
probably right. We had an email in Madison from Anna. Probably the only person complaining about how hot this May has been. I think it's just been big swings between hot and cold days with a few moderate days, even though May isn't over. Do you know if we had more days in the 80s than usual? I don't think so.
I would guess we did not.
Did we break 80 just once?
Maybe 3 or 4 times. Maybe we had a 90 once.
Oh, and, we did. I've been traveling a lot in May, so
but she is right that when that happened, it was kind of up and down over that period of time. But of course, that's because the basic late spring has been kind of cool on average. But I don't think we've had anything more than our normal, well below normal, would be my guess, of 80-degree days in May.
We did have we have a Facebook comment from Gail, the caller, complaining about the National Weather Service announcing things over a wide area. Maybe. Reacting to the area covered by the broadcaster more than the area covered by the National Weather Service.
If it comes straight from the Weather Service, then it is directed to citizens who live within their county forecast or their forecast area. If it's from a broadcaster using the National Weather Service product, then that could be a problem, possibly.
And we hit an unfortunate milestone on CO2 in the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah.
400 parts per million. Yeah. It hasn't been that high since 3 million years ago or something.
Yeah, a long, long time ago, right.
So that's not good news.
It's going up. And that's, you know, the fundamental kickoff to the global warming that we've been experiencing.
Yeah, it's bad news.
And John, that waitress that gave you that 15-minute warning, Someone wanted to know, caller Tim wanted to know if you tipped her well.
I always do, and I was just thrilled at that. I couldn't stop talking about it. Like, you can tell how excited I am. Yeah, I didn't leave her a meteorological tip, however. But I left her a generous tip. Yes, I did.
Okay. Guys, thanks so much. We'll see you next month. Last Monday of the month.
You bet.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW, our guests, they'll be back the last Monday of next month. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.